Republicans to wake up. The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Welcome to a fresh podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show, beaming to you from San Francisco. As our pronouncer told you, this program is supported by listeners like you, and I want to thank Anoel Rinaldi, a monthly subscriber to the program, and Barbara Eliason of Meadow Vista, California, who made a contribution recently. You can help, too. Just log on to peterbcollins.com. Our voluntary subscriptions start as low as $5 a month. In this program, I welcome back to the PBC show two intrepid independent journalists who have been covering stories that I consider critical about the torture policies of the Bush-Cheney administration, the legacy of Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, and the incredible reaction, particularly by some even Democratic legislators in this country, to the effort to close Guantanamo. Jason Leopold has been a longtime contributor to our program. He was a founding reporter at truthout.org, and we've got some news we'll tell you about Jason and Truthout in just a moment. But back in the day, he worked for the LA Times, for the Dow Jones News Service, and he has broken and covered many stories in depth. Jason, welcome back to our program.
Thanks, Peter. Great to be back with you.
And also joining us from London is Andy Worthington, a British independent journalist, and I want you to know about his website, andyworthington.co.uk. He wrote the book about Guantanamo. We'll refer to that in a moment. And he also has a new film that we'll discuss here shortly. Andy, welcome back to the program.
Hello, Peter. Good to be here.
And as I just made the connection here, you two gentlemen said, well, it's nice to talk for the first time. And that is that is the world of online journalism. Jason, tell us how you discovered the work of Andy Worthington and brought it to your site, The Public Record.
Sure. Well, I've been familiar with Andy's work for quite a while. Certainly his, what I would consider to be the groundbreaking book on Guantanamo. I mean, if anyone is interested in Guantanamo and the detainees there, you know, have to pick up Andy's book.
Which is called the Guantanamo Files, by the way.
Right. The Guantanamo Files, exactly. And in addition to that, I had just been reading his reports. I mean, the issue he had been, that he has been reporting about are so in-depth, and in terms of not just talking about the detainees there, but the politics that that are behind everything, and it's a topic that I've been interested in because I found it to be incredibly underreported, and the job that he has done has been remarkable.
Yeah.
So a mutual friend, who's also a writer and actually has been on your show, Jeffrey Kay, had introduced us in via online, if you will.
Yeah.
And feel like we're dating or something at this point. introduced us, and I had the public record, and I really felt that Andy's work needed to be showcased and brought to a much larger audience, and that's what I wanted to do, and that's aside from the fact that his reporting is excellent, to be able to bring it to a wider audience. And I think that we've been incredibly successful with that over at the Public Record.
And Andy, when did you get started on your work on Guantanamo? And initially, what captivated you about our gulag?
Well, you know, first of all, your gulag, but one that that standing shoulder to shoulder with as the greatest ally has to be my country, the United Kingdom. I started about 4 years ago, actually, really starting to look in depth at the at Guantanamo, when, of course, even the lawyers were already in the prison and hundreds of men had been released, and there was still very little information. And so I dug away at reports from released prisoners and media reports of, you know, the dozens of men who'd been dropped off in Afghanistan after years and who all seemed to be farmers and taxi drivers, to try and get some idea of what was going on. But it's really 3.5 years now that I've devoted myself to this full time, really, that I began researching a book at the time that the government was obliged to release the names and nationalities of the prisoners for the first time, and also 8,000 pages of allegations and transcripts from the tribunals, which was how I pieced together this this kind of database. Would be rather a nice word for it, but really acres of paper and Word documents and stuff that in which I documented these stories and pieced together eventually a chronology that's enabled me really to carry on working ever since with knowing really quite a bit about who these people are.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the context of their capture. So were they captured in Afghanistan? If so, then, you know, then maybe they were part of some conflict there, but they equally well, they could have been some of the humanitarian aid workers and missionaries who were caught up in the fighting there.
Right.
You know, over 100 prisoners who were captured in Pakistan, far from the battlefield, with no guns in their hands, you know, plucked out of buses and mosques and seized in house raids that, when all that information came together, seemed to be very much based on dubious intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and overriding all of this, of course, is the knowledge that that prisoners were mostly captured by Afghans and Pakistanis. The U.S. military's allies were, at a time when bounty payments were widespread,
indeed,
averaging $5,000 a head, that there was no screening of prisoners in U.S. custody in Afghanistan before they went to Guantanamo. And, you know, I just really stuck to the story ever since. It took me over a year to write the book. And the book, really the way that I see it now, is the kind of launching pad for everything that I've done since, which is I just started off writing about things that needed writing about. I mean, to be honest, you know, the first day that I woke up after my post-writing haze of handing the book in to the publishers was a day that a prisoner died in Guantanamo, and I approached various newspapers, and they weren't interested in knowing anything about who this guy was.
Mm-hmm.
Or they were content to run, you know, buy a small report off the AP. And seriously, I mean, from that moment on, I just thought, okay, well, I appear to be on my own here. So,
well, and Andy, it
I'm
seems
going to write about these stories in depth and see where it takes me. And of course, you know, I've been on this journey through the blogosphere for the last few years, as Jason has, and mm-hmm. we're all discovering that actually, if you really want hard news and in-depth news, then quite a lot of the time, this is where you're going to find it.
Indeed. And your database and detailed records on the 759 men who have been held at Guantanamo appear to be in better shape than the official records. The Obama administration made their decision to close Guantanamo, and then Greg Craig and others started evaluating the information they had on the individuals there. And apparently it's caused quite a delay because the records were in such disarray, and we see that surfacing now in some of the court cases. Now, I want to take a moment here to ask you each to talk about important developments in your own careers. Jason, you left truthout.org about 2 years ago to start the Public
Right.
Record, and that's a great website, pubrecord.org, and it's going to continue, but you are returning to Truth Out as one of their frontline reporters.
Yeah, actually, I'm returning there, returned this week, as a matter of fact, as deputy managing editor.
Mm-hmm.
In addition to doing reporting. So it's I'm really looking forward to it because it's an opportunity to truly enhance and push forth some of these hard-hitting stories that we have just that Andy has just talked about that I've mentioned over at Truth Out. In fact, you know, I can tell you that you can expect to see Andy there as well. You know, he's somebody who's written for me, and I want to bring him over to Truth Out, because, you know, Truth Out has a it's established. It's been around for 8 years. We have a very, very large audience, and I mean large in terms of numbers.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a great opportunity to to be able to overhaul some news operation and really start focusing on breaking news, what's coming out of Washington, and take writers like Andy and put them on a platform where they can expect to get some wide readership. I think what he said is really important in terms of approaching some publications, and they're just not interested. That's a shame. But the public record is near and dear to me. I mean, to have the opportunity, to literally start a website and to watch it grow to the point where, for me at least, you have somebody like Keith Olbermann who, recognized one of our stories and actually mentioned the website and the story itself on MSNBC.
Mm-hmm.
At one point. It meant something to me. But I'm looking forward to this new project, and the public record will continue with others at the helm, and I will remain a editor at large,
mm-hmm.
More like a consultant.
Mm-hmm.
So this is great, and like I said, I think you'll start seeing Andy's work, over at Truth Out as well.
Very good.
And that's very nice to hear as well, Jason. And of course, we have it on tape now, so.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
And this recording is available for just a nominal fee, Andy, if it's ever ever useful to you. Now, Andy, I saw on your website when I visited recently that you have a new film that will be debuting in London in a couple of weeks, and it's called Outside the Law, Stories from Guantanamo. Tell us about it.
Well, this is a project that actually started a couple of years ago, and I've been working on it, particularly with a good friend who's a filmmaker. And we had to fit this in with the many other things that we were doing in the early days. So we essentially tell kind of the story that I tell in the Guantanamo files. So we focus a lot on the U.S. administration's flight from the law, and we focused a lot on how people came to be in Afghanistan and Pakistan to be rounded up, and explain part of the story of how not everybody who was there was a militant, and also attempt to explain some of the differences between Al-Qaeda, a terrorist group, and the Taliban, a despised government, but a government nonetheless, and their civil war against other Muslims in Afghanistan that preceded the 9/11 attacks and had nothing to do with Al-Qaeda. And we focus on a few particular stories of prisoners, which we kind of weave in and out of this narrative. And it's mainly, it's pretty old school. It's composed of a bunch of people talking about their experiences.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got a couple of Guantanamo lawyers, got Tom Wilner from Washington, D.C., who was involved from the very beginning in the Rasul v. Bush Supreme Court case with the Kuwaitis held at Guantanamo.
Right.
Clive Stafford Smith of Reprieve over here in the UK, who's very well known as a Guantanamo lawyer.
Yes, he is.
But we also interviewed a couple of released British prisoners, Mozan Beg, who's quite well known, and Omar Degayas, who was returned getting on for a couple of years ago from Guantanamo. We kind of had the first major interview,
mm-hmm.
With him. And I think he's really the human heart of the film, telling his story of, being kidnapped at gunpoint from a house in Pakistan, and his experiences of Bagram, which he describes as like a Nazi camp, and all the terrible things that happened to him, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
I'm also in the film kind of tying the whole thing together, if you like. And,
uh-huh.
We worked on this when we could. We've been doing a lot of work on it recently to finally get it finished. And of course, there's a deadline coming up. And I think showing it this fall, although in the minds of a lot of people, Guantanamo's over, of course, it very much isn't over. We're actually mm-hmm. in a rather difficult stage here, where we have the president's pledge to close it and all these obstacles to that actually happening.
Yeah.
The difficulty of returning prisoners to countries where they face the risk of torture, the obstruction from lawmakers on both sides within the United States, mistakes that have been made by the administration.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm hoping that we're going to get quite good reception for it. I mean, where we take it from here, we're looking at film festivals, we're looking at trying to broadcast it in the Middle East. We're looking for distributors. We'll kind of see how it goes, but mm-hmm. I'm sure there will be many people around who will want to see it and will help us find ways of getting the message out to the people that can.
Well, indeed. After it premieres, let's figure out when we could bring it to the U.S. and show it to some groups over here, and I might be able to help you with, I know, one documentary film distributor here in the Bay Area.
Well, that would be great, actually. I mean, I am coming over in early November, actually, for about 10 days. I'm
uh-huh.
going to New York, I'm going to Washington, D.C., and I'm coming over to the San Francisco area for a few days as well.
So. Well, then we've got to meet, and we'll conspire at that point.
Let's do that indeed. That would be great.
And you mentioned Moazzam Begg. He was detained and has quite a story of his own. He now he started a website called cageprisoners.com, and we have a podcast interview with him that's available at peterbcollins.com. I was really touched by my conversation with him. Now, gentlemen, as we're talking here on October the 9th, it's just been announced that President Barack Obama has been awarded the Nobel Peace Prize, and I have yet to read the proclamation and the details of it. But on the face of it, I'm nonplussed. It may be aspirational on the part of the Nobel Committee, but this is a president who was elected to end the war in Iraq, and to my knowledge, not much has changed there. We're talking about it, and there are big plans for next year, but still... I'm not very pleased because even the most optimistic plan leaves 50 to 75,000 U.S. troops there for a very long time. And meanwhile, this Nobel Peace Prize designee is mulling a further escalation of U.S. presence in Afghanistan, which I think is just pure folly. And so let me get each of you reacting to this breaking news about President Obama and the Nobel Prize. Andy, you go first.
Well, I have to say as well that to give the Nobel Peace Prize to somebody who is still mired in two wars, I mean, that would be the most generous way of saying it, seems incomprehensible. I can't understand how you would be able to give a peace prize to somebody who's actively involved in two ongoing wars. But as you say, I think there's something very aspirational about it. I think it's intended to provide some kind of spur. Now, internationally, I suspect that this would strengthen Barack Obama's hand in negotiation with other countries where he wants to pursue some kind of dove-like approach. But I'm not entirely convinced that that is the approach that he wants.
Mm-hmm.
Ironically, I mean, I have just written about this today, but ironically, I think being given a peace prize by the Nobel Committee is also going to enrage the right wing in the United States, who will take it as yet more confirmation that Barack Obama is soft on national security.
Yeah.
Which, of course, is not the case, because actually looking at it objectively, you've highlighted, we've spoken about the problems of being involved in a war, but on some other issues, Barack Obama is not really deserving of a prize that nominates somebody for what they've done to help peace. He's still talking about dealing with some of the Guantanamo prisoners that he finds a bit difficult by essentially carrying on holding them for the rest of their lives without charge or trial.
Indeed.
He's spoken about how Guantanamo has only been a recruiting sergeant for Al-Qaeda, but really the idea that under any circumstances you can carry on holding people without charge or trial is going to carry on being a recruiting sergeant for Al-Qaeda and contributes nothing to peace. And this plus other things that are going on, the rumors that we've recently had that actually renditions are now taking place in Bagram, the lawsuits that the administration has been involved in to prevent information about Jeppesen, who's the CIA's travel agent.
Right.
From being explored, to prevent rights from being extended to prisoners in Bagram. I mean, I could go on.
You could, yes. And the other one that disturbs me is our Fourth Amendment rights that have been violated by this massive eavesdropping and interception program that continues unchecked and unabated under President Obama, the former constitutional law professor.
Absolutely.
And Jason, in getting your comment, yeah. I'll just pass along a waggish remark that was emailed to me by my friend Gary Chu in Sacramento. He said, Obama won the Nobel Prize. Well, at least it didn't go to Rio.
I guess this would be considered the consolation prize.
Yeah.
You know, here's my feeling on the Nobel committee's prize. You know, I have to, you know, my first question was, how would people have felt, certainly how would I have felt, getting the news, say, last December, you know, before he actually stepped foot in the White House? And I have to say that if you look at Obama's campaign, if you, you know, look at the time that spent on his campaign, certainly promoting that theme change and what he was actually trying to bring about, and how that amounted to a revolution in a sense, because truly it did mobilize people in ways that we have never, ever seen before with a figure of, you know, his stature. I would say I have to understand it. It totally makes sense. You know, given the fact that 9 months passed since he has been in office, I think that's why we're asking, you know, some questions now. We've seen that that in fact he is not living up to many of the things or promises that he made on the campaign trail, which, by the way, is you know is not a surprise because that's. You know, politicians do that all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I think that Obama had made such grand promises. Certainly, you know, ending the war in Iraq. I mean, come on, when he was campaigning as a senator, and I was actually having a conversation about this with one of the folks over at Truth Out, that you know, he was campaigning as a senator. He wanted to end the Iraq war. You know, things have changed dramatically. I mean, the fact, like you said, that he is, you know, possibly considering escalating the war in Afghanistan.
Again.
Again, you know, to the tune of perhaps, you know, 45,000 U.S. troops. Who knows? But in addition to that, you know, the fact that there really is no accountability on issues of torture, and what sticks out for me for the most part, is a couple of weeks ago when he was speaking to George Stephanopoulos. It was either George Stephanopoulos or Bob Schieffer. Actually, it was both of them, where he was talking about, he was asked about the issues revolving around ACORN,
mm-hmm.
The grassroots organization. And he said, yes, I support investigation into ACORN. But when he was asked about the fact that you know the Republicans and former CIA directors had called for this probe or this review of torture to be dropped, you know he made it very clear that he wants to move forward, he wants to forget about it, so to speak. So these, you know, the juxtaposition between the two really does not seems like that's someone who, you know, you would think about, hey, this is a guy who won the Nobel Peace Prize, and he wants to make sure that there's, you know, not only accountability, but that we, you know, make these substantive changes that people will see. I think that right now it's really, it's what could be. I think the Nobel Committee recognizes what could be as opposed to what is right now. And I think that certainly, if he, you know, if we were just to talk about health care reform, you know, what could actually come about as a result of that, how that could change, you know, certainly the, you know, the situation and issues revolving around that in this country, and certainly what his potential is,
mm-hmm.
Would be deserving. But it's, you know, it's questionable right now.
Well, with all due respect to the Nobel Committee, I would file this one under premature ejaculations. And the other one that's in that same folder is Henry Kissinger.
Yeah.
who remains an advisor to this president, as he has been to every freaking president since he left his post.
And,
if you believe in the idea of a deep state, Kissinger certainly represents that. Well, gentlemen, I want to move on to some of your recent reporting about Guantanamo Bay. And Andy Worthington, you have done some remarkable things, and I, again, want people to visit your website, andyworthington.co.uk. You post almost every day, and you cover these issues better than the American media does. So the recent developments include that 75 individuals have been cleared for release. The last count I saw was about 223 to 225. So this would bring the count down to somewhere between 100 and 150. And what I'm not clear on is of those 75 cleared for release, how many are from Yemen? Because the last I heard, there were about 100 Yemenis still detained at Guantanamo, and they have presented thorny problems in terms of relocation to their home nation.
Yeah, well, yeah, absolutely, they have. I mean, the difficulties, the best analogy to draw for people really is that there were over 100 Yemenis and over 100 Saudis in Guantanamo, and given that the majority of the 9/11 hijackers were Saudis, that rather soured relationships, the otherwise very close relationship between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia for some time. But particularly when there were some deaths in Guantanamo in 2006, I think that was particularly the spur for the Saudis to say, look, you know, we've kind of had enough of this. All the Western countries have had their guys back. We'll set up this rehabilitation center, and we want our guys back. And in fact, almost 100 Saudis were released in 2006 and 2007, who went through this rehabilitation program to have religious leaders teach them that the kind of teachings of Osama bin Laden were not really appropriate for somebody who was a good Muslim, and to help these people get on their feet and resume their lives. Now, we've heard a lot of right-wing lies about what happened in the rehabilitation program and all the recidivism, which is actually very small, a handful of people. Mm-hmm. Have drifted off to a violent path.
And it's not hard to imagine that there were innocent individuals sent to Guantanamo who were radicalized and became militants, partly through the tutelage of fellow prisoners and partly because of the treatment that they received from us.
Well, sure. But, you know, to go back to the Yemeni issue, this is part of the problem now. is that, you know, Yemen, being a more unstable state, has never been able to get it together to introduce a similar program that would have seen, you know, certainly a large number of these nearly 100 Yemeni prisoners return. So they're still there. Now, in this latest announcement of prisoners who have been cleared for release by the Obama administration's interagency task force, executive review, I mean, not open to the public, but, you know, this is the body that was set up to make conclusive decisions about what was going to happen to these guys. And they've been through all the cases now, finally, having managed to pull information together. And they've decided that 26 of the Yemenis can be released. Now, you know, as far as I'm concerned, there's no problem with putting them on a plane and flying them straight to Yemen and releasing them. But no, because of these fears that they might have been radicalized, that they're still held, and these doubts are lingering. And it seems very much to me that there's absolutely no way that these men can get to leave this place. You know, some of these guys were also approved for release from Guantanamo by the Bush administration, by military review boards. Here they are, you know, almost a year after Obama's in, they're cleared yet again, and yet it doesn't matter how many times they're cleared. The word comes down saying, you know, Yemen's too dangerous a place to release people to. These guys might have been radicalized. Might this, might that. How'd you get out of this place? You know, that's really what I want to know. And if this were to be applied, of course, to any other context apart from the magical word terrorism that makes even rational people lose all reason, we would be saying, you know, well, actually, you know, when somebody served a prison sentence, it's really not a very good idea to release them at the end because they might have been radicalized by what happened to them in prison. It's just somewhere where reason flies out the window when Guantanamo is concerned, and this huge specter of fear that was pumped up so much by Dick Cheney primarily is still stalking the land, and I find it very disappointing.
Indeed. Now, gentlemen, I want to ask you each to describe a case that you recently wrote about in some depth. And before doing that, I just wanted to note that as I was researching and recapping some of your recent articles from each of you, that a common thread surfaced, and that is that the courts are really taking the issues here and taking on the U.S. government, both the Bush administration and the new Obama administration, over detention policies, over the torture that occurred, and that the judges involved are all females. Now, I don't want to draw too much from that, but I think it's worth mentioning that Susan Crawford is a military judge who has just flatly acknowledged that we tortured Al-Qahtani. And Jason will talk about that case in a moment. And it's a female judge, Rosemary Collier, who is presiding over the issues of Al-Qahtani, who has been very strong and direct in her criticism of the government. And then finally, in the case that we'll discuss with Andy in a moment, Judge Colleen Kolar-Catelli has been very, very firm in her interpretation of the rights of individuals and the extra-constitutional behavior of our government. So, Jason, let me ask you to give us a quick thumbnail on
sure.
the recent discussion of videos of the torture of Mr. Al-Qahtani.
Well, this is really a stunning development, and certainly I would think that you know, some people are probably not surprised just by the fact that there is more videos of documented a case of torture. Al-Qahtani was somebody that the Bush administration had referred to as the so-called 20th hijacker. If I'm not mistaken, there's many of individuals that they're referring to as a 20th hijacker at this point, or that they had referred to as that. And he was captured in February 2002, by the way, which was months before the Justice Department had issued a torture memo. The August 1st, 2002 torture memo authored by John Yoo, signed by Jay Bybee, Ninth Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals judge. And we do know that Al-Qahtani had been brutally tortured during interrogations at Guantanamo by military interrogators. And, that's obviously by military interrogators and even, outside contractors. And, that's a bit different, obviously, from what we have come to realize and what we have been told with regard to the way the CIA had been operating. And his torture was actually documented in what's been called a torture log that was leaked several years ago. But the fact that the government, the Justice Department, had just revealed in court papers that there are actually videos and audio that exist about the torture is truly remarkable and absolutely underscores the need for a real investigation. First of all, let me just say that Al-Qahtani's interrogation, I say interrogation, it has to be referred to as torture.
Mm-hmm.
His torture was sanctioned by Donald Rumsfeld. In fact, the videos that the judge actually said must be turned over for the Center for Constitutional Rights, who is representing him in this case, coincide, the date of these videos coincide with an edict returned by Donald Rumsfeld, in which he personally signed off on the his brutal interrogation. So, I think that what they're doing is actually trying to establish, a timeline here to show, or at least the Center for Constitutional Rights, to show that, what happened to Al-Qahtani, was not only, not only were the statements that he made the result of torture, but it was the result of a specific executive order returned by Donald Rumsfeld. And I actually believe that Susan Crawford, the military commission's judge, who said that, quote, you know, we tortured Al-Qahtani, I believe that, you know, she was well aware that these videos existed and would not allow the war crimes prosecution to go forward because the evidence, you know, was certainly not only obtained through torture, but because this eventually would come out. And I believe that she knew that. And obviously, you know, what happened was is that Center for Constitutional Rights tried to get from the Obama administration, you know, they filed a discovery request. They wanted, you know, a return of, you know, any sort of videos, audio that existed to show that, you know, he was tortured and that the statements he made came as a result of that, which he had said for, you know, for a long time. And sure enough, you know, last week, a judge, the judge Rosemary Collier, had issued a ruling saying, in fact, that the videos need, you know, from the specific date in November 2002, which span about a week, must be turned over to the defense. And actually, I believe that we may actually, you know, hear about that a bit more next week when it's turned over. But you know, as you know, there have been about 93 videos, if I'm not mistaken, that, you know, that torture videos that were destroyed. This doesn't fall into the investigation that's currently underway by Special Counsel John Durham, who's investigating the destruction of those tapes. But what this really says is that we, you know, our government, you know, tortured, we know that they tortured so-called war on terror prisoners, and they did so to, you know, specifically to extract information that was bad information. And now we actually have a direct link to Donald Rumsfeld. I have said for quite a while now that Donald Rumsfeld has the most exposure can be directly linked to specific cases of torture more than any other Bush administration official. And I actually believe that Donald Rumsfeld could absolutely be, you know, charged with war crimes in his own right. If anyone had the, you know, the balls to, you know, to pursue that.
Well, and Jason, one of the things that is clear from the details in your article is that Al-Qahtani was tortured even by the torture definitions served up by John Yoo and Jay Bybee that, oh, you had to be close to organ failure. Because, as you cite, there was one point where he was hospitalized, Al-Qahtani was, because the torture and the sleep deprivation, the combination of all these tactics, had caused his blood pressure to drop, and they were concerned that he might die. So in this case, this meets the standard, which I don't approve of, that Holder set for any prosecutions that might occur over the torture process. And as you point out, the direct linkage to Rumsfeld here suggests to me that Holder ought to be, you know, circling in on Rumsfeld right now.
Absolutely, Peter. And you know, what's also really important that I must, you know, attach to this as well is that this happened at the same time. Now, this was Guantanamo, but around this time that Rumsfeld issued this order on specific interrogation methods. And by the way, you know, I actually, you know, I document this in the story as well, that Rumsfeld regularly checked up on the interrogations of Al-Qahtani. So he specifically, I mean, we know that Donald Rumsfeld personally made phone calls, you know, to find out about the, how the interrogation was going. And, you know, around this time that he issued his executive order, his, you know, signing off on these methods, was the same time that two detainees in Bagram in Afghanistan were killed as a result of that same order. Okay, mm-hmm. And these detainees were, or at least one of them was discussed at great length in the documentary Taxi to the Dark Side.
Right.
So there's a real direct linkage here to Donald Rumsfeld and to war crimes, and there's really no other way to describe it. The fact, you know, that these, you know, tapes exist certainly will help the defense, or you know, the Center for Constitutional Rights that's representing him. I think that it will help establish that, you know, in fact, anything he did say was a result of torture and therefore cannot be prosecuted. But as Andy just, you know, mentioned, what does that mean? You know, to get him out of there, that's highly unlikely. I don't think that, you know, certainly it hasn't been truly established that, you know, he was going to, you know, be this 20th hijacker. What happened was he tried to get into the United States. He was turned away by an immigration official, captured a short time later, taken to Guantanamo, and brutalized to the point where, he almost died on a number of occasions. And like you said, that meets the definition of torture, but
I'm saying it meets the watered-down definition of torture from you and Bybee and the watered-down prosecutorial standards of Eric Holder. So there is no excuse, is my point.
You know, there is no excuse. And here's the bottom line. You know, I think that it's highly unlikely that we are going to see anything in this country that represents any sort of prosecution. In fact, the investigation that Holder signed off on is a whitewash in its own right. I mean, that's the only way to describe it.
Sure.
If these investigations, if this evidence, continues to come out, and we do not allow the investigators to actually go to the top of the food chain, so to speak, where you actually, you know, start deposing people like Donald Rumsfeld and investigating them,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's meaningless. And, you know, the fact remains that, that, like I said, Donald Rumsfeld has the most exposure. In fact, I think, if I'm not mistaken, Michael Ratner over at the Center for Constitutional Rights wrote this, you know, this book, The Prosecution of Donald Rumsfeld.
Yes, he did.
I may have mangled the title.
No, you're right.
But the fact is that, you know, that book came out, I think it was about a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
But now, look, you have this evidence that we have, we have documented evidence that, yes, the government is holding on to torture tapes of this guy whose torture during this time period that was captured on tape was signed off by Donald Rumsfeld.
Yeah, now let me...
And you have the Obama administration, by the way, that's continuing to fight the release of any further evidence that would clearly establish, real crimes. And if I can just add one more thing, what's really unfortunate in the case of Al-Qahtani, and as I said in the beginning of my comments, that, the news just came out this week, it's truly been underreported.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that the country has become desensitized to a large degree to many of these revelations. And reporters actually, you know, have as well. The only time, Peter, that we're going to really see some real coverage and front page news revolving around the issues of torture from here on out is if, you know, it connects Dick Cheney. If there's a smoking gun that, you know, actually connects Dick Cheney, which I think we've seen plenty of those, but that's the only time that we'll see real coverage is when, it involves a former Bush administration officials.
Mm-hmm.
Stories like this are still going to be relegated to the back pages, six paragraphs. Hey, look, you know, there's a torture tape.
Jason, thank you for that. Now, Andy, before I ask you to describe the case of Mr. Al-Rabia, do you have any comment on what Jason just reported regarding the videos and this direct link to Donald Rumsfeld?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Jason's absolutely right about Rumsfeld's quite open culpability for things. What I think is particularly interesting about the Arcatani case centers on Susan Crawford's extraordinary confession, you know, which came about a couple of weeks before Bush left office. She was obviously trying to establish where she stood on things. Now, you know, she's the convening authority of the military commission. She decides ultimately who's going to be charged, and she refused to press the charges against Al-Qahtani because, as she explained to Bob Woodward in this extraordinary interview, what had happened to Al-Qahtani met the definition of torture. Now, you know, what's particularly interesting is that when she was defining it, she explained that it wasn't necessarily that each of the individual things that were done to him rose to the level of torture. It was what happened when these things were combined. And so, you know, everybody's interpretation of things, Eric Holder's interpretation of things, for example, that he's looking at people who crossed the line according to the rules that were laid down, which attempted to redefine torture, that he's looking for these kind of isolated incidents as well. And nobody is really addressing the question of however much these things were approved, which they shouldn't have been, and the OLC lawyers who approved them for political reasons and attempted to redefine torture were wrong. But even within those limits, it's only Susan Crawford who, from inside the administration, the Bush administration, who has declared publicly that the combination of these factors in Al-Qahtani's case led to torture, and that we could therefore, I think, very easily draw from that conclusion that other people who were subjected to a variety of enhanced interrogation techniques to which they were subjected, you know, with these things happening at the same time, mm-hmm. were also tortured. And it's really one that, you know, needs looking into. I mean, sadly, I agree with Jason that the will just doesn't seem to be there for this to be pursued in the United States.
Well, I decry that because will is not the issue here. There's a constitutional standard, and Obama is trying to say, you know, it's inconvenient. And this is similar to Pelosi taking impeachment off the table because it was considered politically risky. And I'm sorry, in both cases, those are the wrong calls. And if we are to be a constitutionally based nation, then we've got to live within that framework. Now, Andy, let me ask you to describe for our listeners the case of Fuad Al-Rabia, who is a Kuwaiti national who was taken into our custody in 2002. And this is a bizarre story because basically he's one of those people who was trying to figure out how to get out of Guantanamo. And as many people have told us, under duress, you will say what you think your captor wants to hear.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, yes, Fuad Al-Rabia he'd worked for 20 years for Kuwaiti Airlines at a desk job. Anybody who's given some information about him as a physical human being would know that the desk job is all that he did. He's overweight with health problems. He also, every year, did humanitarian aid work, and in 2001, he decided to do some work in Afghanistan. He traveled out there in July. He made inquiries about how to get aid to people who were suffering in Afghanistan. He then came back to implement some of these things and unfortunately arrived in Afghanistan just as Operation Enduring Freedom began. So like so many people, he's then caught up trying to get out of the country. He can't get back through Iran, where he came by land, because the borders were closed. He eventually ended up being caught up you know, around the Tora Bora Mountains, around the crossing point into Pakistan, by the Pakistanis. He ends up in Guantanamo. And the story as I knew it, and, you know, bear in mind, this is from my point of view as somebody who has studied the stories of the prisoners in as much depth as the public information is available for many years now. Now, he had a tribunal in Guantanamo in 2004, the Combatant Status Review Tribunal, where the prisoners were allowed to at least present their side of the case when the allegations were put to them. And then in most cases, the tribunal went away and decided that regardless of what they said, they were an enemy combatant anyway. But, you know, he was given the opportunity to tell his story. And the story that he chose to tell, which as a result I found credible, was that he had met Osama bin Laden in the summer of 2001 when he went on this visit. He was introduced to him. He also said that as he was trying to leave Afghanistan, he got caught up in the war between al-Qaeda and the U.S. forces taking place in the Torabora Mountains, and that a senior al-Qaeda official had made him run a counter in the mountains before he'd made his escape and had been captured, before he'd been allowed to leave, rather, and had been captured. And it was a very long and complicated story, and it seemed credible. You know, there were gaps in it, but it seemed to be a coherent kind of narrative. Now, it took until a judge just a few weeks ago went through the full information about this man's case in his habeas corpus petition to discover that actually it was a pack of lies. All of it was a pack of lies. That what happened was that when Al-Rabieh came into U.S. custody, they didn't know who he was, so they spent a year or so trying to find out and couldn't find out anything because, of course, he had no involvement with terrorism. He was a businessman and a humanitarian aid worker. And then some other prisoners in Guantanamo started saying that he'd met Osama bin Laden, that he'd delivered a suitcase full of money to bin Laden, that he was a big man in Tora Bora. And they spent some time trying to get him to admit these things, and he refused. And then they introduced enhanced interrogation techniques. Now, primarily, I think they subjected him to the frequent flyer program. It's a horrible euphemism for sleep deprivation, where they would move prisoners from cell to cell every few hours over a period of weeks or months. Now, the exact time period is classified, but I suspect from hints that I've heard and from what other prisoners have said about how much he suffered, that they actually did this to him for months. Woke him every 2 hours. I mean, no 24-hour break. Every 2 hours, moved him from cell to cell. At the end of which he cracked basically and said, "Okay, well, you know, what do you want me to do?" You know, and when they were playing good cop rather than bad cop, then they said, "You know, it's fine. Just tell us that you did these things, and nobody's going to get out of here." He said that an interrogator told him, "No one here is innocent. You have to confess to something if you ever want to go home."
Mm-hmm.
And so the judge got to see how this story had developed, and the very dubious witnesses who had made up these stories in the first place, how he'd confessed, how interrogators had believed that his lies weren't truthful, but how every time he tried to recant them, they'd started getting heavy on him again. I mean, the whole sordid story is laid out as it's unfolded over years, even in the heavily redacted version that was made available to the public. And you know, how shocking is that, really, that even for somebody like me who studied it in such detail, I'd believed for years that there was a truth to this story. Now, even if that had been true, it didn't make him an enemy combatant, because he accidentally met bin Laden, he was accidentally in Tora Bora. But no, all of it was made up. And why was that? Well, because he was subjected essentially to the same enhanced interrogation techniques that Jason was talking about, that were specifically tailored for al-Qahtani, but they then spread and were, from what we can gather, applied to at least 100 prisoners in Guantanamo. Anybody that they thought was hiding information from them, anybody who spoke English, anybody who'd been to the States, at least 100 prisoners. And, you know, the techniques that they used were the ones that they reverse engineered from techniques taught in U.S. military schools. Torture techniques. That were taught to train, that are taught to train U.S. personnel to resist interrogation. And missing from the logical minds of anybody involved in this, logic was clearly not the strong point, was that these techniques were taught in the military schools as these techniques had been learned from the Korean War, when they'd been used to produce fairly famous false confessions by captured U.S. pilots. The whole system really gives false confessions. It's not about using it in real life to gain actual intelligence. So really, you know, we shouldn't be surprised that what it produced was a pack of lies. But, you know, this particular example, what an absolutely disgraceful and clear example of cruelty, wrongheadedness, stupidity, counterproductive behavior on the part of the Bush administration. Really, really shocking.
And Andy, I just want to lift one quote from your article that is largely a quote from Judge Collar Cotelli. Despite ruling out all of the government's supposed eyewitnesses and noting that the government had withdrawn most of its reliance on these witnesses by the time of the merits hearing, the judge added, it is very significant that Al-Rabia's interrogators apparently believed these allegations at the time they were made and therefore sought to have Al-Rabia confess to them, despite the well-chronicled unreliability of the first two supposed witnesses. So this is bullshit chasing bullshit.
Yes.
And at a certain point, it is to the credit of this judge that she cut through the BS and basically said, you don't have anything on this guy, and therefore you must release him. Now, what is the current posture of the Obama administration about releasing this innocent man who confessed to things that he didn't do after being tortured?
Well, they could appeal, you know. I very much hope that they won't, because it would not be possible, I don't think, to be condemned any more soundly by a judge than they were in this case. These things obviously take time. Nobody gets a ruling like that and goes home the day after, because a Q-80 has just been returned. And why Fuad was not on that plane with him, I have no idea. But I would think he'll be home, you know, soon. But, you know, just to follow up about the judges, you know, this really is the only venue in which, in this whole sorry 8-year history of Guantanamo and of these extra-legal detentions, it's the only venue in which something close to objectivity is actually seen. The judges are looking at both sides of the story and are just simply concluding that the evidence isn't there. And although most of the judges involved have been women, I have to say that they're not all. Some of the first decisions that were made last November, for example, with a group of Algerians who had been living in Bosnia who were kidnapped and brought to Guantanamo. Some other cases, Mohammed El-Gharani, who was a young Chadian teenager who was seized in Pakistan. Abdul Rahim Al-Ginko, who was, this is again, a truly extraordinary story. A young man who had been persuaded to go to a training camp in Afghanistan, but almost as soon as he went there was regarded as a spy by Al-Qaeda, who then tortured him, and he was imprisoned by the Taliban for 2 years. He came into U.S. custody. They got the idea he was a terrorist and brought him to Guantanamo. And they tried to get a judge to say, despite all those things that happened to him, he had this tie to Al-Qaeda and the Taliban that still exists, and the judge threw it out and was enormously critical of him. And this man, Judge Richard Leon, was appointed by George W. Bush and is a conservative.
Mm-hmm. Well, I certainly accept your point there, but I do think these cases that we're talking about do have some very powerful female judges, and I just want to salute them in that respect.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, they're really, you know, the judges are just doing the most extraordinary job, and, you know, again, it's not front page news. I really think that it should be, because they're right at the front of the most extraordinary battle that's been going on for so many years to establish, are we a nation ruled by laws, or are we subjected to the whims of a deranged executive?
Mm-hmm. And Andy and Jason, as we wrap up here, I just wanted to get your comments briefly on the posture of the Congress, because Obama was stunned earlier this year. I think the Senate vote was 86-7 or something like that, to say that we don't want any detainees from Guantanamo brought to U.S. soil under any circumstances. And we're seeing now a softening and some legislation that's being offered to permit them to be brought to this country for detention and trial with the provision that they could never, ever, ever, ever be released, no matter what the circumstances, onto American soil. And from my perspective, not only is this backward and wrong-headed, but it plays into the hands of the original concept that Bush employed here, which was to pretend that Guantanamo isn't part of the United States, and that therefore our laws, our constitutions, our constitution and the treaties that were signed to would not apply. It's as if this were an orbiting platform in space or something like that. And so we're continuing with this mythology by pretending that, oh, yes, well, we could bring them to our courts, we could house them in our prisons, but by simply virtue of the fact that they were held at Guantanamo, they are therefore guilty, they are terrorists, and therefore we need to create a new class to prohibit them from ever, you know, living in the United States under any circumstances. Jason, your comments first?
Well, first of all, I think that, it's true. The Congress stunned Obama by, with its vote to not allow, any of these, not only to not allow the detainees, but to withhold funding to close Guantanamo until, the Obama administration had a better plan. But the fact remains that, this Congress, and I have to say that the Democrats have been the biggest disappointment that I have seen in quite a while. First of all, they are absolutely, their decisions are dictated on, by the polls. I believe that any decision that they have been making is a result of fear-mongering by Republicans who basically will try to use this idea that, if we bring a Guantanamo detainee or detainees to our backyard, we risk putting our own country at risk. And in addition to that, I think that, the media, the right-wing media, in a sense, takes hold of that and runs with it and tries to show that the Democrats are weak. They want terrorists in our neighborhoods. People who, by the way, and to a large degree, haven't even, gotten their day in court. So the fact is that I think that this Congress is simply knee-jerking. They are reacting to bad press, publicity, negative publicity. If you look at some of the activity that took place in this country, terrorist activities that took place in the 90s, for example, we have already, as I said before, I believe during some conversations we had, Peter, that we have already incarcerated some of the so-called worst of the worst in maximum supermax prisons, in the United States. I think that, Obama is going to be hard-pressed to find that this Congress, the Democratic majority, will do anything that, will help that effort. I think that his, relocating the detainees or even holding them in this country is not even a possibility. And if they are held here, it's going to be one of those not in my backyard scenarios led by, Republicans. I mean, look, Dianne Feinstein said, made some comments a couple of weeks ago where, she said, we could have them in California, or some of them. But she quickly backtracked, once the media and Republican lawmakers have, jumped on it. So, the fact of the matter is that this is all about politics, Peter.
Yeah.
This is absolutely about watching out for, being reelected in 2010. And that's what's dictating this. It's not, constitutionality, rule of law, that went right out the window. This is about, do I want to take the risk as a lawmaker to, take a stand saying that we can have these individuals in supermax prisons in this country, and risk the negative publicity that would result from it.
Mm-hmm.
And in that regard, I think that you won't see that. You will not see any lawmaker taking that kind of stand.
Andy, your comments, please.
Well, of course, I broadly agree with that. I mean, it's unbelievably depressing because the whole approach that is taken by the Republicans, but by so many of the lawmakers in the Democrat Party on this is exactly Dick Cheney's dream come true. It's as though nothing changed, and it's as though you know, it's as though there wasn't a change of administration, that the same process is still in place whereby all these guys who have never been charged, never been tried, have never had the opportunity to test the evidence against them, it's regarded as true that because they were captured and because the president said these guys are enemy combatants, proof is not required, that actually still counts. And that's really, really chronically depressing, actually, 8 years on, that that lawmakers are prepared to go for the fear factor and not to examine at all really how extraordinarily wrong this whole thing has been.
Mm-hmm.
I've no idea. I mean, I think an enormous amount of pressure has been put on in the last few days to get them to at least concede that they can be brought to the U.S. for trials. Because that appeared to be off the cards. And I'm looking at it from outside the state. I can't understand it. I thought we'd reached a point where there was an understanding that that something had to be done about this. I do think that President Obama was shocked in May, as he should have been, when the Senate first turned around and pretty much said, "We don't want you doing anything here. You know, mm-hmm. we want to pretty much prohibit you from doing anything." But I do have to say that I wish that he hadn't missed the opportunity that he had when he came to power, which I think was the chance for him to do something bold that would not ultimately have backfired, and that was to find a way to bring some of the Uyghurs to Guantanamo. Now, these are the Chinese guys who everybody right. who's had any contact with is cleared of any wrongdoing, any connection to Al-Qaeda, anything to do with the Taliban. All of this. Only one enemy, China, never a threat to the United States. Now, you know, some of these guys who've been cleared for forever, who were ordered to come to the United States, the Obama administration, there's a slip, the Obama administration backed the Court of Appeals, the very conservative Court of Appeals, in a ruling in February, when the Court of Appeals said it is no way can the court order this to happen. These are immigration issues that are solely to do with the executive, refused to bring these guys to the United States. Now, I don't know whether you or the listeners saw, I'm sure some people did, four of these men were eventually rehoused in Bermuda in
right.
June.
Mm-hmm.
I've never seen a group of men who less resemble a group of terrorists in my life. And I can swear to you that if President Obama had been bold enough to bring these men to Judge Urbina, as he said, you know, this is habeas corpus, he said, bring them to me. I want them in this courtroom.
Mm-hmm.
I want these guys to resettle in Washington, D.C. with the Uyghur community. They've given me plans for how to do it. If those men had been brought to Washington, D.C. and had been wandering around the shops buying ice cream and chatting to people, it would have done more than anything that I can imagine to pierce this insane paranoia and fear that's been stoked up by Dick Cheney and the people who think like him, and would have demonstrated really in one fell swoop, hey, mistakes were made at Guantanamo. We understand that now, and it wasn't done, and that really disappoints me.
Yeah. Andy Worthington, thank you for joining us from London today. Again, your website, andyworthington.co.uk. And we look forward to your visit to the U.S. in a few weeks, and I hope to meet you in person. And I also want to thank Jason Leopold for joining us today. You can read him at truthout.org and pubrecord.org. Thank you both.
Thank you, Peter.
And thank you for listening to this edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Your comments are always welcome. Email Peter at peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to until we meet again, happy trails.